You are tearing me apart, Lisa!
My girlfriend sucked 37 dicks.
In a row?
Hey, buddy, you gonna eat that sausage?
No, go past this. Past this part. In fact, never play this again.
Tell me something, my friend.
Am I the only one around here who gives a shit about the role?
Ladies and gentlemen!
Your complete attention, if you please.
The Epic Film Guys Podcast. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to a brand new episode of the Epic Film Guys Podcast. I'm Nick, and we are going to drag out the opening of this show as long as humanly possible before we get into the much better second segment. Spoiler alert, we're reviewing Mandy tonight.
It's happening. We talked about it briefly in our patron-only segment last week, but unless you're a patron of the show, you didn't hear that. But it was still only brief. We wanted to wait for our good friend, the self-proclaimed god of podcasting himself. And yes, I'm Justin, by the way. The sauce, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, self-proclaimed and also just generally proclaimed by everyone that I am the god of podcasting. My name is Brian Loy, a.k.a. Loy Sauce. Thank you again, gentlemen, for having me on the show. I'm looking forward to talking about some movies tonight.
You're not my dad.
We're not there yet. God damn it. I haven't yelled at him yet.
But yeah, so much to unpack here at the beginning of the show. Justin and the Sauce are going to be reviewing The House with the Clock in Its Walls a little bit later. And second segment of the show, we are diving deep into Mandy.
Mandy.
We're also going to review a film. Ba-dum-tis. What? Yep. We're still juvenile. Coming off of an amazing, and I mean amazing, time recording with Paul and Wayne over on The Countdown, talking about our top 10 raunchy teen comedies of all time.
Where what a blast that was.
Put together a hell of a list, I think. I think we put together a really, really great list. And I don't know. We'll see how the vote goes and see if we can sway their listener community enough, you know, to side with us, to believe in us and Justin's love of pie enough to get us over the hump.
I mean, I grew up, my grandmother made me lots of pumpkin pies, but she also made me an apple pie once in a while. And I took great advantage of that.
But yeah, ladies and gentlemen, of course, this week, earlier Monday, we dropped Justin's interview with James Jude Courtney, the brand new Michael Myers in Halloween. And
amazing interview.
It was great. Wonderful job, Justin. We absolutely loved it. So big shout out to Jeremy Todd Moorhead for putting that whole thing together. And hopefully the first of many more interviews that Justin and possibly the Sauce will be doing for you guys. But yeah, that episode is exploding right now. So if you're just listening for the first time because you caught that and you wanted to check out an actual episode of the Epic Film Guys, we mostly don't talk about movies. It's mostly dicks and sometimes Loy Sauce.
And beer, too.
And beer.
There's beer.
And Loy Sauce is a dick.
And Loy Sauce is, well, definitely that. So, yeah, we just love to have a lot of fun. We love to talk movies. We don't have a moment to waste here, gentlemen. So I want to go ahead and get over to a time-honored segment here on the Epic Film Guys podcast. And I, of course, am talking about What Are You Drinking?
I'm back! Puke and rally!
And I am actually going to steal the thunder here. I'm going to lead it off because I'm drinking something I've already had on the show before. I've already had it before. I bought myself another bottle of Eagle Rare 10-Year Bourbon. And I feel like dog shit tonight. And this is actually helping me feel a little bit better. I did not want to drink beer just because I was afraid, like, you know, it would just be like too much or something, you know. So just a couple of glasses of Eagle Rare. Neat, all I need. Again, it tastes like sweet whipped cream. It's amazing. I love it. But I want to kick it over, not to Justin, but ladies and gentlemen, the god of podcasting. What do you have spilling into your sucker
spit
of
hole.
Penises?
No.
Spit hole. Spit hole.
Yikes.
Ew.
Well, Nick, I'm glad you asked. I'm actually drinking something that I know you'd love.
Ooh, he loves it so much.
It is a special edition release, pumpkin ale
from... Oh, good for you!
This is actually the Schlafly pumpkin ale from the St. Louis Brewery. And I am no connoisseur of pumpkin ale or beer in general, but I've had a few pumpkin ales, and this is by far the best that I've had. Certainly the most pumpkin-y. A lot of times you'll drink a pumpkin ale, and it'll taste like, it'll taste kind of like...
It tastes like most of them, like most of the brewers just accidentally spilled all of the cinnamon and nutmeg into the batch.
Correct.
Yeah.
This actually has body to it and a flavor that goes throughout your mouth.
And we know Loy Sauce loves him some body.
I love body and I love flavors all in my mouth. So this beer is actually, you know what? I'll go so far as to say delicious.
Whoa.
I love that beer. Whoa. That is a go-to pumpkin ale. That is probably known as one of the best pumpkin ales down here.
Justin actually introduced me to this beer. He gave me one while I was over there. And yeah, I fell in love with it. So thank you, Justin.
Speaking.
And thank you for finally coming on the show and actually drinking a goddamn beer.
Yeah, this is the first time in what?
Yeah. I know.
Like his last like three or four different appearances, he
like five,
had
dude.
Nothing.
Like five. Yeah. He had nothing to drink
insane.
But me.
Insane.
You know, I kind of got the pumpkin beer thing out of my system a little bit early.
Thank God.
So I went back to my New England. Hey, I'm not done yet. I'm not
just getting started.
I'm just getting started. That's right, Loy Sauce.
Daddy's so gonna spank drinking you with the belt now.
My favorite part about having Justin sound drops on the soundboard is that I can make Justin cut himself off.
You just did it. Thanks a lot, buddy. But I'm drinking the Grove Stand Milkshake IPA from none other than Aslin Beer Company. And Nick, I didn't tell you this yet. I just found out they just announced that within the next year, they're actually closing their Herndon location.
What?
Yes. They're going to be moving to Alexandria.
Houston, right? Yeah.
No, they're moving to Alexandria because, well, they're keeping the Herndon location that they were building up to be one of their tasting rooms, but it's had so many problems with the structure of the building and everything that they're going to move on to a different location that they purchased to go there now to benefit the brewery, obviously. And then they'll work on the Aslin Herndon location later on. So for me, I gotta get while the getting's here. And so I grabbed a Grove Stand milkshake. It's there to make all of my creamsicle dreams come true. They say they hopped this juicy IPA with Citra and Mosaic and added lactose, of course, Nick, as you always know, to round out that mouthfeel.
Mouthfeel?
And they say that this will take you back to the first creamsicle you ever had.
That's
this
a lot
is
of
really
cum.
Good. It's only 6.5% alcohol by volume. It's very delicious. It's sweet.
Mm.
I could chug through it. It's a good pounder, but it's very much a dessert beer for me, and I love it. Definitely recommend.
I did, ladies and gentlemen, tell Justin a little bit earlier before we recorded tonight, I almost bought the ingredients to make my very own pumpkin beer because I'm curious to see if I could brew a beer that has pumpkin in it that I find acceptable. Because as Loy Sauce was mentioning earlier, most pumpkin beers, number one, don't have pumpkin in them. Two, if they do, it's way too much. But a lot of them way overdo it on the pumpkin pie spice. Like, I'd be horrified to taste a pumpkin pie that these people actually made because you'd literally be just eating spoonfuls of cinnamon. Like, that's how some of these beers are. They just way overdo it. So I would like to try my hand at it. I think I will, when I get enough money, just kind of accumulate the ingredients. And I would try to make something, include that lactose. You want that sweetness, that creaminess. You want that pumpkin. So definitely use pumpkin as well. I don't know. I think I could do something pretty damn special.
I kind of initiated this. I said to you, I asked you this. I said, do you think you could actually make a pumpkin beer that you like, that you made yourself?
Well, I don't know.
You
that.
Could
yeah.
say, you know what? It's not Maybe. That bad.
I would definitely be willing to try it, though. And then if it's bad, I just send it all home with Justin, and he would probably take a fucking bath in it because he loves his pumpkin beer so much. So it wouldn't even matter.
Bathed in every day of the year, baby.
I believe you two fine gentlemen have a film review for us here to close out our first segment. Is that correct?
We do. What's the name of the movie, Brian?
The house with a cock in its balls. Oh, wait, that's not right. The house with, sorry, the house with a clock in its walls.
I can't get the name of title. I can't get the name of this movie right. The house with a clock in its walls.
The house with a cock in its balls. You heard him.
We did see this movie, but before we saw this movie, we actually saw something extremely special, something that we've both wanted to see for an entire year that was connected to this movie. Loisos, what the hell did we see in 3D, man?
Oh my God. Michael Jackson's Thriller in IMAX 3D. This was a limited engagement playing exclusively before IMAX showings of The House with a Clock in its Walls. So. Correct. So to be able to experience this legendary music video, which has not been released in any kind of HD release of any kind, to be able to see it on the big screen in all its glory in 3D with the surround sound, it was, well, I'll just say a phenomenal experience.
It was absolutely religious for me. I even said in my social media posts, sure, I'll watch the movie that comes after it, but I'm here for Thriller 3D. And you and I had talked
about
this.
Worth the admission.
Definitely worth the admission. And what surprised me was I loved that so many people were in the theater, didn't even know that it was part of this theatrical engagement. Like a lot of people were like, what? What is this? It just popped up. And then the Thriller in 3D, the title screen comes out right in your face. It's that old school 3D. And obviously John Landis has come out on record at screenings of the film in 3D and said, I never shot it for 3D. That was never the intention, but they went through and added basically depth. It's what they do in a lot of post-production 3D films now. But there are a couple elements that they went in and they made it really gimmicky, like the titles coming out. And for me, it's one of my favorite songs. It's special to me because I remember still seeing it as a kid, 10 years old, in my grandparents' basement. They had the TV down there, and I'd stay overnight there. And I remember when it came on, and you saw that opening warning about the occult and how, like, you know, Michael Jackson's basically warning you, like, as fans, this shit's dark, bro. This shit's,
yeah.
And it scared the crap out of me as a kid. And I've been looking forward to this for a long time. I've known that it's a thing. They did it. They didn't release it on Blu-ray, but watching it on the big screen, the whole theater, there was just this aura about the theater. It was an amazing feeling.
And people jumped several times too. Like, it's a scary video. It really is.
There's one thing at the end too.
At the very end of the Thriller music video, there's that one, I guess, female zombie that kind of turns toward the camera and it freeze frames. With the IMAX, with the IMAX release, they made her like jump out.
Dude, the whole row we were in, I felt it. Like everyone go up like 5 or 6 inches off of their seat.
Which is so great. I mean, they didn't mess with the video itself. They didn't try to add any flashy gimmicks, or they didn't try to George Lucas it special edition this video. But that was one thing that they added, I guess, just for fun, just to kind of give it a little very punchy ending.
Very genuine restoration. It definitely is a true 4K restoration that they did. I mean, to the point where all the film grain's still there. They didn't scrub anything away. You could see Michael Jackson's, like, the makeup they put on you for music videos. You could see it on his face. But when he was in prime form, it's one of the best albums of all time, one of my favorite albums of all time. And I feel very appreciative and thankful that I actually had the advantage and the opportunity to see it on the big screen, especially. And I'm not a 3D fan. Our listeners know that I'm not a 3D fan. You know I'm not a 3D fan, but for something like that, it was very special to me.
Absolutely. He was the king for a reason. After that, you know, whatever movie we ended up watching, it wasn't going to compare to what we just saw. But we watched The House with a Clock in its Walls, the very awkwardly titled, based on a book by John Bellairs, with illustrations by Edward Gorey. And Edward Gorey, if you know anything about Edward Gorey and how distinctive and stylized his illustrations were, it was a book that I vaguely remember as a kid. I had not read it since then. And so going into this film, I was curious because this is also a film directed by Eli Roth.
Ooh, that name usually doesn't give you the most confidence in the movie you're about to watch.
It sends shivers up my spine, and not for the reason that I'm sure. Right. So, so I was curious because with the trailer, it looked like it was kind of throwing it back to kind of the old school 80s vibe. And I saw the Amblin Entertainment logo, Steven Spielberg's Amblin Entertainment. And I was thinking, you know, there might be something to this movie. But Eli Roth has not directed one film that I've liked ever. So I went in with somewhat lowered expectations, and I guess I'll just go into what the movie's about. It's basically about a 10-year-old kid named Lewis, played by Owen Vaccaro, I believe is how you pronounce his name. After the death of his parents, he goes to live with his uncle Jonathan, played by Jack Black. And those of you who know me know that I adore Jack Black. Even in the crappiest movies, I still think he's a joy to watch. He's a little kooky, he's a little strange, and his house, the titular house with the clock in its walls, is odd because Lewis begins to notice paintings move. There's a chair that acts like a dog. It's like a sentient chair. It's almost like a lap dog, but it's a chair.
It reminds me of Cherry from Pee-wee.
Exactly. Pee-wee's Playhouse, yes. And he just begins to notice a ticking sound that keeps him up at night. Just there's some sort of strange ticking sound. It is actually a doomsday clock counting down to the end of time. Basically, Uncle Jonathan reveals that he is actually a warlock, a male witch, as they say in the movie. And he starts to teach Lewis a little bit about the magical arts. It just kind of goes from there. And at one point, Lewis uses his magic to accidentally awaken the dead. And that brings in our villain, played by Kyle MacLachlan, who's hamming it up. Justin, I'm going to just throw it to you. What did you think of the house with the clock in its walls?
Well, first, before I get into my initial thoughts on this, there is something that you told me before we saw this movie. You had told me a quote that Steven Spielberg told something very particular to Eli Roth before he made this movie. Do you remember what that was?
Make it scary for the kids.
If I recall, it was something like scare the shit out of those kids. And there's always been those stories floating around that Steven Spielberg says he's always wanted to do a super scary movie. Like, he's always had these deep ideas on how to really make a movie that scares the pants off people. But because of his...
Well, this ain't it, but...
I'm just saying. This gets close, though. This movie initially had literally zero expectations for. Now, I'm not a big Jack Black fan. I'm still one of those guys that argues with Loy Sawson, says that he was totally miscast in Peter Jackson's King Kong. Yeah, I know I'm going back really, really far.
Great. He's great.
But I do like him, and I loved him in Goosebumps, and I thought that was a lot of fun. But for this, like, I was literally not thinking it was going to be anything, and I walked out extremely charmed in every single way. This movie had imagination. It had vision. And it had something visually stimulating that almost knocked my socks off. And you could tell there was a craft here. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to say this right off the bat.
Did you just say craft in an Eli Roth film?
Yes. This is Eli Roth's best movie that he's ever made. I can't believe that I actually enjoyed a movie of his. Now, I'm not going to go back and hate, okay, I like Cabin Fever. It's fine. All right, Hostel, for what it was, well made. Fine. But the guy's had a ton of missteps since his early days to now. And watching this movie, you can tell that the guy's had a lot of ideas on how to, you know, bring out certain elements of fantasy and horror. And he finally had the opportunity to do this. Now, you had said this movie isn't that scary. I found it to be as far as it could possibly go.
Oh,
with,
sure.
With its rating, mind you, of PG, it goes pretty far. You see some blood. You see some really scary visuals. I mean,
the devil is in this movie.
many, many times. And the way that it's shot, it's done straight up horror style. And, you know, like,
Jack, a few jump scares, too.
A couple of good jump scares. Jack Black is in top form here. But the person that I love the most was Kate Blanchett, who obviously she can do no wrong. I've never
I didn't even mention her, forgive me.
Never see her in a bad performance. And she plays Florence Zimmerman, who is, in parentheses, the next door neighbor to Jonathan. Mm-hmm. Which they're obviously kind of like I forgot how they put it, like they're domestic partners in a way.
They're platonic, as they say.
Platonic, yeah. But they work together here, and they've been working together for a long time trying to find out where the clock is in these walls. And I feel like
because they figure that if they find a way to turn off the clock, then that keeps doomsday from happening.
The whole thing about Lewis is that he just lost his parents. spoiler alert if you haven't seen it yet, but that's why he that's why he's sent to live with his uncle, and this whole magical world is realized before his eyes. And I really like that kind of imagination. This movie really did bring me back, Brian, to when movies were more simple. They didn't have to abide by any kind of tropes, and the tropes are there, but I mean it's not as deadpan as a lot of other movies are, where it goes right by the book. There are some things that happen here where they take some chances. And I feel like as a family oriented film, this thing won me over in every single way.
I agree. It reminded me of the first Harry Potter in that way, where it kind of slowly introduces you to this world, where you get a little bit of mystery here and there to keep you engaged into the world that's unfolding before you. And here's my stance on kids movies. I think kids need to be scared. I think, kids are fine. They can handle it. I was scared by plenty of movies growing up, the Neverending Story, the Dark Crystal, movies like that, that scared the absolute bejesus out of me. Being scared builds character. I miss movies like that. You don't really see kids' movies like that anymore. The biggest insult to me, and I'm kind of digressing here, but the biggest insult to me was
I know where you're going with this.
Was a movie called Trolls, DreamWorks Trolls, where the main message of that movie is, are you sad? Well, don't feel sad, feel happy. And that is the complete opposite of what I want my kids to experience. Like, if I were a parent, I would 100% take my kid to The House with a Clock on Its Walls over Trolls any day, because this movie, there's genuine emotion, there's scares, there's humor, there's more to the movie other than
there's true heart in this movie. This movie has a heart.
There's one scene that actually got me genuinely choked up. It's a scene between Jack Black and Kate Blanchett, and they're both talking about the losses that they've experienced in their in their lives, and it's very emotionally affecting. Now, does the movie have its kind of more sophomoric, kid movie potty humor? Yes, there's a poop joke that they repeat four times where I'm like, okay.
I mean, I laughed the first time. I mean, I'm not usually the guy to do that, but I mean, I did laugh.
But yeah, but they repeat it four times. Yeah, it's like, they feel like with the kids movie, it's like, remember that? Here it is again. It's like, all right. Overall, the movie is good natured. It is scary. There is a part where you see a literal demon split a guy's hand open and lick the blood.
it's a demon that looked like it would be out of an R-rated, like almost like out of The Witch. That's how far it goes with the visual look of everything. And going back to that heart, this movie deals with the loss of family members. This movie deals with relationships and how those are built and how you deal with people and bringing new family members into your life. It deals with alienation, obviously, and that's one thing that's why a lot of people were referencing, like, this kind of felt a little bit like a Tim Burton movie, because Lewis is an outsider. He basically is obsessive over this TV character, and he wears these goggles all the time, and of course none of the kids pick him in gym to play basketball with them or anything. So that's a trope that's there, but obviously it's done very genuinely, and I feel like the performances here really make it worthwhile to watch. Nothing here was bad. It was all good. And again, that's so shocking for me to say when talking about an Eli Roth film. And I got to go out of my way here and talk about the production design, because this movie takes place in the 50s, and they absolutely nailed it. John Huttman did the production design for this film, and God.
It's a little whimsical. It's not quite the 50s.
It's his own alternate version of the 50s. It's a more happy, happy-go-lucky, not-so-realistic version, but it also did what I want to have it do in this kind of movie, is it transported me to a different place, Brian, for the hour and 45 minutes that I watched it, and I didn't think one minute about what I had to do when I left the theater. It took me to a different place to think about.
You know what I loved? Not one of the kids pulled out a cell phone. Not one of the kids dabbed in the movie.
More movies are doing that, and I love it. Bring it back to an old time when they didn't exist, and I'll enjoy the movie even more, because then it doesn't lead me to want to think about what's on my phone or anything like that. So,
There's a part where they go to an old fashioned candy store.
Oh, I love that
scene. There's all these like retro candies, and there's a soda bar, and it just like it transports you back to a simpler time. But also, what the production design does in this movie is transport you to a whole other world. This house is a character in and of itself. It's literally a living, breathing character. It looks like a place where you'd want to live. It's kind of like a cozy house, but it also has deep, dark dungeons in the house. And many scenes where they go into the basement and there's creepy like clown statues and secret passageways. And
the secret passageway, Brian, tell me how that opened. What is that?
It's a demon mouth. Like the
dude,
it's like
and the way it opens, it's so cool. The tongue comes out and the big fangs open up. It's so amazing.
Yeah. So if I were eight or 10 years old and I watched this movie, I would be in love. Like, it has everything that kids like in this movie. And again, it's spooky. It's a great Halloween treat. It's not going to terrify your child, but there are parts in it that are genuinely, they have a genuine horror atmosphere. So
there are only a couple things about this movie, Brian, that I didn't like. One being Kyle MacLachlan, who is one of my favorite actors.
Oh, he was great.
Underutilized, but he hams it up in great makeup, by the way. Amazing, almost Oscar-worthy makeup job. But he's not in the movie that much. When he is, he's really having a fun time with it, but I wish that he was utilized better. But there is one scene before we get to our ratings, because we have to make this review quick. This is a mini review for the show. One of my favorite scenes, and this is literally right out of the back of my brain and every single horror Halloween lover that is out there. They have to fight off a bunch of killer jack-o'-lanterns. And that sequence
which is amazing.
Was one of my... And it happens more than once. They fight them once, and they come back and have to fight them again. And when they fight them, it's so visually entertaining. And there's pumpkin guts splattering all over the place. Almost like Roth was like, why don't we shoot this scene like they were killing zombies, but instead it's just killer jack-o'-lanterns. So you see pumpkin guts splattering all over them and all over the place, and it's so gory, but it's just pumpkins. But I loved the visuals of that. They nailed everything
you guys,
about the season.
I'm telling you guys, this is a movie where Kate Blanchett takes an umbrella and uses it as like a gun to shoot off like killer jack-o'-lanterns.
And all these jack-o'-lanterns are exploding everywhere. And dude, the way they shot it was just so visually entertaining and just so energetic. And I just
a little bit heavy on the CGI. I would have liked to have seen more practical effects. They did practical effects where they could, but I feel like they could have utilized them more.
Well, the budget, the budget was like, what, 40 something million on this thing?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, that's just me wishing it were, you know, a little bit more practical to give it even more of that 80s Amblin vibe. I also wish, and this is, again, just me, there were more blood and guts in the movie. I know it's a kid's movie. There's one moment where I'm like, oh, that could have ended in a glorious, gory, just like mess of blood and gore. But, you know, alas, it's a rated PG movie.
It's PG,
movie,
and I think they went as far as we saw blood. We heard a couple curse words in this thing. You know, I mean, literally. I'm happy with it.
Me too.
I'm ready to get down to our ratings of this thing. I definitely recommend it for each and every one of you that has a family. If you have small kids out there and you want to take them to see something during the Halloween season that's fun, that you'll enjoy as well, I highly recommend checking this movie out. And I actually feel like I'm going to go as far as saying, Brian, this could be added to your Halloween watch list every fall season for you and your family to sit down to watch, because it deals with a lot of issues. Again, loss of family members, becoming a new family, being alienated, and then of course good Halloween cheer in there as well. I'm going to give the film a 7 out of 10 rating. I thought it was a really, really entertaining, good movie.
I agree. Well, I think I have to look at the movie for what it is, because again, I could go into what I would want it to be, just to suit my tastes. But I look at it as a children's movie. And for a children's movie, this is one of the better ones I've seen in a while. As far as live action family entertainment goes, I think this movie gets an 8 out of 10 for what it is.
Whoa, okay. There are
things about it that I have mentioned. A little overuse of CGI. The second act sags a little bit. I feel like Kyle MacLachlan and Kate Blanchett kind of disappears from the movie for a while, and you want to see more of her character. But overall, as I said, this is a perfect Halloween treat. I mean,
we didn't talk about this, but there's a moment when Lewis actually brings back, I won't say the character's name, from the dead in a graveyard where there's fog everywhere, and he brings it back from the dead.
And you see that rotted hand come out.
Oh, dude, that's literally everything that you want to see in a movie like this. And that's why you're saying as a children's movie, I'm saying as a movie in general, because I don't get some of that stuff in some of the horror movies that I watch, you know,
like that's that imagery
is there, man. So yeah, I get it.
So for someone who has shit on Eli Roth, even as recently as this year with Death Wish, which is still the worst movie I've seen all year, I can't believe I'm saying this, but Eli Roth knocked it out of the park with this one.
So there it is, ladies and gentlemen. The house with a clock in its walls gets a glowing recommendation from the Epic Film Guys podcast. Those of us that have seen it, of course. So again, this Halloween season, take your family to see it. Check it out. But we're going to take a quick break here. And when we come back, dun, 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 we're going to be talking about Nicolas Cage in Mandy.
$565,900
podcasts. Oh my gosh.
I'm pretty good, right?
That's amazing.
Yeah. Please don't keep that in the show.
Oh, that. Oh my God. That is going to be the opener, James.
Did I get the number right?
No.
Did I get any of it right?
No.
What is the number, Emily?
525,600 minutes.
Nice.
Thank you.
Now we all know Emily can actually sing nearly as well as I can.
Nearly. Oh, not even close, no. James. You can always tell when we have recorded our second episode of the night because we've already had a lot
we're
of wine.
A little looser, yeah. A lot is not. Two bottles is not a lot.
Two bottles is not a lot.
Two bottles is not a lot.
I hate when people say you don't need alcohol to have a good time. You don't need running shoes to fucking run, but they help, goddammit. Yeah.
You know how sometimes you're not going to fuck your mother, and then you are going to fuck your mother? That's exactly what he's saying.
Did you know Mr. Pibb was a Dr. Pepper ripoff?
Yes.
By Coca-Cola. I never knew that because no one's ever had Mr. Pibb.
We don't have Mr. Pibb up here. We don't need a Mister up in Connecticut.
We want only drink sodas with Dr. in the title.
We only drink sodas with a pH fucking D.
Yes, please.
Are these Ben and Jerry's flavors?
Uh-huh.
Or are they an Emily pun?
Okay. Nice.
Are you ready?
Oh, yeah.
Some of these I got from the internet. They're not all me.
Okay.
That's my jam.
That's an Emily pun.
That is not. That is
no!
A Ben and Jerry flavor.
What?
Yeah.
Oh.
Raspberry beret.
Ben and Jerry's.
Nope.
What?
That's mine. Empowerment.
Ben and Jerry's.
Yes.
Finally.
Wu-Tang Flan.
You. Please tell me that was you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Go shorty, it's your birthday.
I'm so torn. You.
Yeah.
Okay, thank God.
That was the internet, so. Robert Brownie Jr.
You. Pets are apparently not allowed at the Vatican.
But if they were, it would be called the Catican.
It sure. And also, there's a category of cats who brave the high seas.
Yo, on the Meoceans.
The what?
Meoceans.
Yeah, that's what I thought you said.
Yeah. If I had a record of all popping, that would be great.
Get Orville Redenbacher's 1976 hit, The Colonel Plays Them All.
Ooh, it would be a pop album. Yeah.
Fuck, Emily. Stop making my voice into a robot's voice, Emily.
Stop giving me the ammunition needed in the recordings to do so, James.
Emily, it hurts my feelings when you do that.
I want that non-robotic voice. I do not sign on for that.
Sir, buddy, little man, little Mimi, hair man.
Sir Ploppington.
Sir Ploppington.
Uh-huh, baby yeah. Buster.
What can you, can't like yell out to him. I just like kept walking like, yep, I'm the guy who puts dog shit in his pocket.
Like, where do I stand?
Oh, James, you would be kicked out even before number 32.
You could placate me a little bit.
No,
let's try
I can't.
That again.
I can't, no.
Where would I rank this. Emily?
You'd be number one, James.
Thanks, Emily. This is a classy little podcast with James and me, Emily.
You know what? You put the men in menstruation, which is why
oh,
we need
Jesus.
Chocolate.
Oh, Jesus. Is it that time again?
What? Come on. Be the John Ralphio to my Mona Lisa right now, James. Come on.
I think I can speak for everyone who's ever listened to the Classy Little Podcast when I say, we're going to miss you. Thank you very much, Emily, and thank you, James, for all of the great episodes and great moments that you've given us. We'll be right back.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very, very much for sticking with us here on the Epic Film Guys podcast. Hope you enjoyed your EFG history break and your review of The House with a Cock in Its Balls, or Cock in Its Walls, Clock in Its Walls, Cock in Its Clock, Cock in Its Clock. So, ladies and gentlemen, we are about to take you on a journey of utter insanity. And lamentably, that journey will include the last film score ever composed by Johan Johansson, which is sad. Really, really sad to think about, because I'll say it from the outset, the score to this movie is brilliant. Excellent score. No matter what else we say about the rest of the film as a whole, it's important to take that away from it. But of course, we are going to be talking about Mandy, written and directed by Panos Cosmatos. I don't even know where to begin.
Words are escaping me when I think about this movie, because a lot of times I feel like movies are made just for me. But when I go to see them, they don't fit the bill. There's something that bothers me, or there's something that doesn't quite click with me. But Mandy was one that came out of left field. It came out of nowhere. I wasn't expecting it. The first time we saw the trailer, people had already been seeing the film when Nick and I had talked about it for the first time on the show. So when I sat down, it'll be like 2 weeks ago by the time this episode airs, and I saw an early screening of the film, my mind was fucking blown into pieces in every way. I had no idea what I was in for with this thing. Visually, I hadn't seen anything like this in my entire life.
And I'll say, if you're the person that lives in a market where you are lucky enough to be able to catch this on the big screen, it was only playing in the DC area because of the god of podcasting himself, ladies and gentlemen.
I thank you.
Yeah. Alamo DC was the only theater in the entire area that was even playing it because of the sauce. It's not airing a lot of places. So if you can catch this on a big screen, do it, because it's worth it. In spite of, I've got to do it, all right?
Oh, no.
Shut up! Shut up! Shut up!
No!
Wrong!
Now shut the fuck up and let me do my
shut
job!
Up! Stop it, you wing, you baby! Shut up!
I
shut up! Shut up!
Despise the first half of this movie. Despise it. Because it's visually gorgeous. It's lit, and the production design, it's amazing. Johansson's score, haunting, emotional, incredible. But it's paced literally like a snail traveling 20 miles up a hill trying to fuck another snail. Like, it's excruciatingly slowly paced. And I'll say it, I hate the demon voice filter. I hate it. It drives me insane after a while, to where, no, like, you made so many good choices here. So many good choices. But again, I think that the first half of this film is like legitimately, like, I've never seen anything move so slowly in my fucking life, ever.
Have you ever watched a Stanley Kubrick film?
Yeah, and it was worse. It was excruciatingly, but I was ready to turn it off. But wow. I made myself stick through it because I knew we were getting somewhere, and I knew it was trying to develop and build itself to something. I know other people disagree. JD from In Session Film loves the first half of the movie, thinks it's even better than the second half.
But I disagree there.
Fucking
I disagree there, but
hated it. Hated the first half of the movie just because it, like, literally, I wanted to pound a spike into the tip of my dick That's how bored I was. It's just, fuck you, Panos Cosmatos. Faster.
So, Nick, what did you think about the second half of the film?
Well, we'll talk about that when we get there. But I want impressions on the first half of the film, because really, the film is very, very split. Once you get to the bathroom scene, which we'll talk about, this film completely shifts gears, and it goes into 100% overdrive.
Well, and see, this is why I think that the first half works so strongly, is because there's a very sizable shift once the inciting incident happens. Once the catalyst that sets Nicolas Cage over the edge happens, the movie is paced very slowly to kind of, I think, jar you when the movie suddenly goes absolutely apeshit bonkers. And I think that was a distinct creative choice. I think I certainly was not bored, because the movie almost hypnotizes you. It hypnotizes you with its visuals and its music, and it kind of draws you in.
Gorgeous to look at. And again, Johansson's score, I can't say enough good things about it.
Do we know the budget of this movie? Because again, like I'm assuming it's a very low budget film, but they made the most of it. I mean, the way this movie is lit, the way that it's shot, I mean, it's just phenomenal. So I think I was more drawn into that first half based on the merits of again, how it looked, how it sounded.
My problem with it, and I want to delve into this just a little bit more in terms of the pacing here, because I think my problem with it, you get to meet Nicolas Cage's character and Andre Riseborough's characters. You get to meet them, and you get like a little bit of a picture of them together. The film does spend a little bit of time with them, mostly visually, though. It's a lot of nonverbal stuff, which I really, really enjoy. They give very, very good performances, very convincing performances. And then when it shifts the focus over to the cult, it spends way too much time with them, in my opinion. I think that it doesn't need to. And like I said, a lot of it is purposefully slowed down. It's a lot of long monologuing. It's just really frustrating to me.
I think the reason why we get a lot of time with Mandy and Red that it's slow and quiet, because their conversations and some of the dialogue and the behavior towards each other almost hint at like a difficult past. Maybe they had a hardship previously, and it seems to be, based on what I saw, maybe I'm wrong about this, but that Red isn't a recovering alcoholic. Obviously, we see later on that the character has a bottle of alcohol hidden. So, I mean, to me, it seems like they've both been through a lot in their lives. They live this very quiet relationship in the woods where they want to kind of stay clear of everything else. And when shit hits the fan, you kind of see those things fleshed out a little bit more. So for me, like, again, and I understand where Nick's coming from, because he does not like Nicholas Winding Refn films. And for me, I love them. I'll take 30 minutes of just beautiful visuals with a great score any day of the week, as long as when the characters start moving and they start changing and they start being defined, it's all worthwhile. And I feel like with Mandy, for me at least, I'm like, oh my God, okay. There's film grain. There's lots of fucking film grain. This shit was shot on Panavision lenses. Okay, sweet. That's great with me. And by the way, I guess they actually took in film grain from old films and put it over this film to give it the film grain. So it's not a natural film grain. So it's kind of quote unquote revisionist, if you will.
Even still, but it's nice stylistic choice.
Literally seeing it on the big screen, man. I mean, you see so much film grain. Like, again, for me, I was just so intrigued from the get-go on this with the look and the feel and the sound of it all. And of course, Nicolas Cage. I mean, it's been a long time. I can't even tell you guys the last time I personally saw a movie in the theater where Nicolas Cage was one of the leads. It was probably one of the National Treasure movies. Seriously. So I loved the first half.
So then, so as Loisos said, the inciting incident happens and hijinks ensue. We get a scene of Nicolas Cage's character in a bathroom.
That's where you see acting. You see,
and that's where you
performance.
See, you're waiting for this the whole movie, because everyone prior to the movie playing at Alamo Drafthouse, there was a whole montage of crazy Nicolas Cage clips. that played. Nick, you would have loved it. I know you would have been sitting there laughing your fucking ass off, chugging beer to
Not
it.
Not the bees.
The they bees. That, the, yep. the whole bees thing was like literally like five. They played it. It was great. And you get to this moment and you're expecting crazy Nicolas Cage and you get it and you're enjoying it. But at the same time, wow, what an amazing performance. Because you're with him so far from the beginning of the movie to this point. You're like, you're connected to him. He's doing a really good job in it. And then when you get there, dude, I was shitting myself because I've tried doing something similar to what he does. I've tried chugging liquor. You can't do it. And dude, in this scene, this is no spoiler, he chugs almost an entire bottle. Is it vodka? It's vodka, isn't it?
Vodka, yeah.
Yeah. And it's painful for me to watch because I'm like, oh, God, I can taste it. Oh, shit, you're cringing. And he's in his underwear. He's in his whitey tighties and he's all bloody and beaten up. And he's just gone through one of the most horrific situations in his entire life. And Nick, he's sitting on the toilet chugging fucking vodka and he's pouring it all over his wounds. Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's especially when you think about the film as it leads up to that, you've got a lot of color filtration. You get a lot of things viewed with a specific hue doused over the entire negative. So things are viewed in blues, greens, reds, a lot of vibrant colors. So it really kind of changes the perspective and like kind of changes the way that you feel about those scenes. The bathroom scene is clean. It's literally just whatever that bathroom is. It doesn't manipulate the image. It doesn't try to tell you a story with the imagery necessarily. It's all 100% Cage. And this is where, when Loislaus mentioned this is one of Nicolas Cage's best performances, that bathroom scene is why. Because I talked about this last week when Justin and I briefly mentioned the film in our patron-only segment, but over the top, Nicolas Cage being Nicolas Cage in a film works when the material calls for it. And then when the material takes you to that place naturally, I think this material does. That scene is so raw. It's so emotional. It's so powerful. It's so, it's almost, you said he's standing there in his tidy whiteys, but it's almost as if he's standing there in front of us naked, exposed, like raw, just
animalistic. We're seeing a very private moment. Yeah, yeah.
Extremely private moment, but it's great. It's horrific because again, yeah, he's dumping fucking pure vodka over these wounds that are still leaking blood everywhere and he's chugging it down and he's just screaming in agony. Like it's insanely affecting. And what that it's literally, you can feel Panos Cosmatos' hand on the fucking shifter, taking this film from first gear into
100%
overdrive. And then, gentlemen, if I may, we get one of the most incredible, epic, if I can say that word on this show, reigns of just absolute chaos, full of just violent, utter, sheer brutality. It holds back when it needs to. Like there are certain characters that we see get killed and there are certain characters that get killed, but they get killed off screen because it's like at one point, I think what Cosmatos really knows here is he knows when enough is enough and he knows when too much is too much. Like it doesn't need to be, it is gratuitous in one way, but it doesn't need to be overly gratuitous, if that makes sense. Like it doesn't just revel in all of these kills. Like each of these kills seems to feel like it has a purpose, and it kind of does in terms of his character's journey. Like there are certain characters in this film that he could kill or that he does kill, but you don't see it on screen. And I think that honestly shows an incredible amount of restraint, because what is it going to add to the film at that point? When, I mean, like I said, you see like some of these kills are so fucking brutal. So
one of the things I wanted to add before we get to that point, though, when he goes to meet Carruthers, he's warned at that point. We don't really know much about Red other than his relationship with Mandy. So we know this guy looks like he's a tough guy a little bit. He's a rough around the edges kind of guy. He's
a lumberjack.
He's a lumberjack. He looks like he could handle some shit. So when you see him go through some shit, you're like, oh man, you feel it even more. But Carruthers warns him that his odds of survival are extremely poor. Like, this probably ain't going to go well for you. And when Red goes out to start running down these guys in the Black Skulls, you see he's actually got technique. You know, he's actually being very precise in how he's deciding how to take them down. And then in the event of him attempting to take all these guys down one by one, he actually gets captured again.
Yep.
So he's very human. We see that this person is not a superhero. He's not superhuman. He's actually run down by one, and he actually gets captured by one, and then he has to get out again. And he has to try to get out.
Dude, like some of the stuff, some of the imagery, and I don't want to spoil everything about this movie because I really, you just have to see it. But there's some fucking imagery in this movie. Like, they nail the motherfucker to the floor. They legit nail him to his the
hand.
Floor.
His hand is nailed. And you see him deal it. It looks so real.
Gruesome. And so, like that shit, like. You can show me a horror movie where, like, literally there's just blood squirting and spraying everywhere, and it's not going to be as effective as the image of legitimately a dude straight up nailed to, like, a bathroom floor, nailed to it. That's just horrifying. Like, to think about, like, just, oh.
I'd like to draw a comparison. So... In that way, Nick, you've made me think of Quentin Tarantino. And Quentin Tarantino is a director. I'm not saying that this movie is stylistically anything like a Tarantino movie.
It's not,
but
no.
Tarantino knows how to balance horrific, you know, realistic violence and cathartic violence. What he knows when to let the blood splatter and when it's, like, genuinely trying for these characters. And there were a lot of moments in Mandy where, again... horrifying. He's nailed to the floor and he's desperately trying to wring his hand free of the nail that's embedded into his hand, and it's brutal and it's shocking. And then you get to the, you know, the more cathartic violence when he's acting out of revenge and just blood's just spraying everywhere. A lot of the kills are over the top. So there's that balance. There's that fine line between the revenge-motivated cathartic violence and the brutal violence that kind of makes your stomach squirm. It's all there for a purpose. It's all there to serve the story. This movie essentially is a Death Wish film. For all intents and purposes, it's your standard revenge picture, but no revenge film has done it quite like this before. You've never really seen anything like Mandy. You've never seen anything like it.
And even so, the director, in a way, makes you go on an acid trip. He makes you feel like what you're watching is what you would watch if you were taking LSD, snorting cocaine, and drinking a bottle of vodka. There's a lot of hallucination in the movie. And I feel like watching the movie in general, Cosmatos wants you to hallucinate based on the visuals and the sounds and what you're seeing on screen. And that's why in one of the scenes, which is pivotal, I'm not going to spoil it, like Voice House doesn't want me to ruin it. That to me was like, there's very precise planning and how this character moves throughout the film and how he's able to do these things. It's not just like that typical fantasy action movie where the guy's walking around, he's been shot 5 times and he's still going to fight 10 of the most deadly men in the world. Like, this movie plans it in a way where you can actually believe it.
Red bears his scars through this film. I want to get to the ending of the film, and I want to get to final ratings on the film here kind of at the same time. And I don't want us to spoil the like final death in the film, but I will simply ask if it worked for you guys in that kind of a sense. For me, I loved it. I really, really think that even again, you almost get a little bit too much into the first half of the film at the end, where I think that scene drags out for a little bit too long, but I love how personal that kill feels. And I think it's executed, no pun intended, I think it's executed extremely well.
Yeah, it's completely satisfying. I think, again, the purpose of letting it drag out maybe a little bit longer is to really hammer home how incredibly satisfying it is when, you know, the action is performed.
The comeuppance comes, yeah.
Oh my gosh, like you're just waiting for it, you're waiting for it, you're waiting for it. It's like Cosmatos is... teasing you a little bit and making you wait for it. It's like the, you know, it's like a strip tease, or it's like, you know, it's like, you know.
Listen, I don't deal with strip teases. Show me the titties already.
Yeah, I don't want to be lewd here, but it's like, it's like foreplay before an amazing orgasm, right? Like, it's like you're getting a lot of foreplay, and then once it hits, it really hits.
Yeah.
And I will say that this movie has one of my favorite endings to a movie, perhaps ever, because not only do you get one final crazy Nick Cage moment, which is my actual, it's actually my Facebook cover photo right now, that shot, which I think is absolutely brilliant. It's slightly terrifying. And then the movie ends on a poetic note, because earlier in the film, and again, I'm not going to spoil anything, but earlier in the film, they're talking about planets, and what planet would you be? And they're talking about astrology, and Nick Cage and Mandy are having this intimate conversation. And then that comes into play in the final scene in a way that broke my heart and made me feel genuine emotion. So I will say that the ending of this movie completely floored me and solidified the fact in my mind that this movie is an absolute masterpiece. I'm going to give this movie, I'm going to give this movie, yeah, 10 out of 10. Easily. Jesus. Second only to Hereditary. This is my favorite film of the year.
Wow.
I absolutely adored it. And again, Nick Cage, there's a moment in this movie, you see the light go out of his eyes. It's one of the most powerful moments to a movie I've seen all
excellent
year.
Excellent performance from Cage on this. I don't think, if I can sell this to anyone on anything, and there's a lot of different things you can try to sell about this film, it's Cage's performance, I think, that ultimately is the selling point of this film. I'm not going to be as kind rating-wise. The second half of the film, 10 out of 10. I adored it. It's utterly incredible, but I feel like the beginning of the film, 4 out of 10. I hated it. So I'm going to merge those two together. That for me is a 7 out of 10. The first half of the film, and I know other people have had this problem with it as well. I'm not the only one that's had a problem with the opening, but
it's not going to work for everyone.
Get through it, I promise you. And even if it is drawn out too much, it is at least visually stunning, absolutely stunning. And I can't say this enough: Johan Johansson's score is masterful, utterly unbelievably good. Justin, we haven't heard from you. Your final rating for Mandy.
Well, not to piggyback so much off of Loy Sauce, because I know he is my son and he wants to be just like his daddy in every way. So I know he's going to say what daddy wants him to say. But for me, this is a straight up 9 out of 10. This is almost close to being a classic in its own right. It's right up there. And piggybacking of what you said, Saucy, Hereditary was my favorite of the year. This is right now just edging it out. It's right there next to it because it affected me in different ways, but similarly where it took me to a different place, it fucked my brain up, but I loved every single minute of it. And you don't see movies like this released ever. And seeing Nick Cage back in top shape in an amazing performance, brilliant performance. I loved the music. You keep referencing Nick Johan Johansson's score. The day after I saw this, I looked on iTunes, I fucking bought it, and I listened to it every single day. It's haunting, it's chilling,
it's
emotional for me, knowing that he's gone, and there are a few pieces in there. I'll mention it when I have more time next week on the show, when I can actually look up the track name, which is one of my, the one tracks on it that makes me almost cry, knowing that a man that just passed away, that went through so much, created music so beautifully. This is a movie made for me. I swear to God, the brutality of it. I love the beginning. You're fucking wrong, Nick. You're wrong. Give me half an hour.
No, he's not wrong.
No, he is wrong. Give me half an hour of just nothing and just minimal dialogue and beautiful shots and film grain.
I get it, man.
And,
you know,
and for me, like, that's what I live for. That's what I love. And I'm glad that we get it because we don't get it anywhere else. No one else would have had the balls to do that.
There
is some
really, really great stuff in the first half of this film.
And the payoff is great. The payoff's great.
I don't want to sell it.
I know you liked it. I know you liked
it. Trash or anything like that, because it's not. I just think, for me, I think it was the wrong creative choice. And you know, that's, I mean, again, it's going to come down to your taste.
No, of course.
To really hone that in, though, I don't think any part of this movie is bad. I don't think that at all. It's not like it. This is not like Happy Time Murders levels of fucking utter garbage. Okay,
it's a completely never have to different hear that
thing.
Again.
For me, like I said, I just think it's the wrong choice stylistically. But even though I think the first half is too long, it's still got, again, the visual flair, the use of color, especially the use of color filters in the film. And I did look at Loisos's cover photo on Facebook while we were, in the middle here. And I love that shot at the end of the film.
Beautiful.
It is,
oh my God,
gorgeous. And I love, that's one of those things, and you've seen this in the trailers and stuff, so you know about it, but Cage gets more and more covered in blood as he goes through this film.
Yeah. And he wears amazing. His wounds on his sleeve.
It's literally. Great, dude. It's absolutely great. So, like I said, it's not bad. It's just not for everybody. I definitely don't think I'm wrong there, because I know that there are a lot of other people that have issue with it as well.
Well, I mean, I'm still going to say you're wrong, but
you
don't take grandma to see this movie. Don't take grandma.
I do want to say this much,
take
because
grandma
Nick,
and be like, grandma, this movie is great.
One of our fans and one of our longtime friends on the show, actually Patrick Sherwood, the Hopester's best friend, who I think is actually secretly the Hopester. By the way, I think I've actually figured that out finally. I told him to watch it. He had seen that I had seen it. And then he was messaging me on Facebook as he was watching it. And he was right at that point, Nick, where you were like, what the fuck's going to happen here? Like, you were waiting for something to happen. And he messaged me and said, dude, does anything ever happen in this movie? And I kind of got a little agitated with him. And I was like, bro, just watch the fucking movie. And that's what I said. Then, like, half an hour later, he was messaging me like, oh my God, this is so great. This is badass. Oh my God, look at all the blood. And he's loving the shit out of it. And I'm like, again, patience pays off.
Stick with it.
No matter what.
And there it is.
Stick with it. No matter what. You will not
see
be
this
disappointed
movie.
In the end.
If you haven't seen this movie yet, it's on demand right now. It's on Amazon Prime.
Get it.
It's also right now available for pre-order on Amazon Prime. The Blu-ray is only $14. Purchase a movie like this. You know why? Because this movie is not getting its legs in theaters right now. It's getting its legs from people like us that love it, that are renting it, and especially buying it. And it shows filmmakers and studios that movies like this will sell, and we can maybe get more.
Yeah, not every movie needs to be the big fucking blockbuster. You know, we can get these small little indie, you know, just gore fests
indie
like
treats.
This that are really, really,
so
really artistic
good.
And whatnot. But
long live Cheddar Goblin.
Long live.
I want a Cheddar Goblin here. I want the Cheddar Goblin to fucking
I want to make a box of Cheddar Goblin right now and enjoy it with my bourbon. But ladies and gentlemen, we love you. We really, really appreciate all of your support, listening to the show, subscribing. Again, subscribe to the show, rate us over on Apple Podcasts. Help us raise up the rankings even higher. We've been crushing it. The interview that Justin just did is absolutely killing it. So thank you all so much. If you listen to that interview, if you're just joining us for the first time, we love you. For myself, for Justin, for the god of podcasting himself.
You're not my dad.
No, I'm not, but I'm like a skeevy, creepy uncle. Thank you very, very much, everybody out there, for listening. And I think I just got puberty there.
We will see you
at the movies.
Daddy's going to spank you with the belt now.
Thank you.